Hello and welcome to another edition of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packer, and we've been busy trying to find 1,000 brown M&Ms in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, the new season finally got underway last Monday, and despite an encouraging display, individual errors cost us, and Chelsea went back to London for the points. Then, on Thursday, a much changed but still strong side, influenced by Alireza Jahanbakhsh, put four past Portsmouth to ease into the next round of the League Cup, where we travel to Preston next week. This weekend, we're back in league action as we travel to Newcastle, which is a city that once again has been put back into lockdown. Let's hope that 3 points are the only thing that we come back with. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we welcome a man who's been trying to coax into Raw Towers for years. He's an actor, best known for his roles in such films as With Nell and I, and Star Wars, Alien 3, and Wayne's World 2, but perhaps his career highlight was starring alongside Perry Digweed in Mean Machine. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ralph Brown. Welcome to the show, Ralph.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You know, who knew that Perry Digweed could actually act? I mean, this was the thing.
Who said he could, you know?
I mean, if we're going to talk about that, because normally, and welcome to the Raw, Ralph. Thanks for coming on. As we sort of somewhat jokingly refer to you as a Raw virgin, but we'll get to your Albion supporting history in a minute. But how did it come to be of Perry Digweed, of all people, getting to play a prison officer in the Mean Machine?
Yeah, I actually have no idea, to be honest with you. I do know that Wally Downes was deeply involved in that movie. You know, Wally of Brentford and West Ham.
Yeah. Apparently you hated him.
No, I'm still friends with Wally. We didn't get on at the time. Long stories, you know, about some of his... I mean, I think these are like football things that he does with footballers. So there's this dirty shirt that gets given to somebody every day, like whoever's going to be humiliated that day. And they do all this... I think it's very old school kind of coaching games. And... he tried to inflict it on the actors, and we weren't having it. He was funny. He's a funny guy, Wally. He was like, okay, you've got 10 minutes break now. All the footballers, I want you to, do a lap of the track. All the actors, just, you know, go and chat amongst yourselves about Pinter. And it was funny, but it was quite tense as well, the atmosphere, because we all had to be fit as anything. And he was quite merciless about... whether we were any good at football and things like that.
Well, it's one of the few football scenes that you get to see. I mean, if you think of other sort of football things like Cares, or you think of Gregory's Girl or whatever, this is a football passage in a film that actually looks realistic. It's, you know, there's long shots where in other football games, you know, someone will score from 3 yards out and it looks ridiculous. But this actually... You know, was that one with many takes, or was it, was there things that you were specifically told to do and not to do, or, you know, was it just basically get on with the game and we'll film it?
No, they were very, very keen to, in their own words, to make the first football film that looked like people were actually playing football. There was a long list of films, Escape to Victory, etc., where the football is laughable. You know, the drama might be, football is always pony, isn't it? And they were very... They were very concerned because they had Vinny, and I think, you know, partly to do with him as well, that let's make the football proper football. So they had real footballers on the pitch amongst the handful of actors. And the actors had to do an acting audition and a football audition. And the football audition was tough. You know, it was Wally Downes pinging balls at you from 25 yards away at sort of knee height, and you had to trap it like that, you know. And so they devised this way of shooting it, right? And it was to do with the camera work as well, really, to make it feel like a real game. And we had to rehearse every move and every moment. And there was a bit when I had to tackle Vinny and foul him, you know. And I did it. And after like the first take, they were like, Vinny comes up to me and goes, Ralph, you got to have me, mate. You got to really have me. And I was like, well, okay, I don't need two invitations. So the second take, I absolutely clattered him and took his legs out. And And I thought I'd hurt him, but he just got up and brushed himself down. Yeah. The ref whistled and had a word. And all the players then clapped me and come up to me and said, Ralph, that was a real Premiership foul, mate.
Oh, really?
I mean, how was Finney like to work with? Because, I mean, obviously, first and foremost, I mean, he was a footballer and of a certain ability, maybe. And but he was, he's gone on to have a brilliant career in film. But I mean, how was it like working with him as a footballer and as an actor?
He's a lovely guy, despite appearances to the contrary. He's a very sweet man. He invited some of us up to his house for his birthday, and we met his wife and his family. And I took my nephew up there, and he still remembers that day. 25 years old today, Jordan, and he was about 8 or 9 at the time. And he's a sweetheart. You know, he's a lovely guy.
Fantastic. Okay, this is the Albion Raw. This is your first time on it, so again, thanks for coming on. But we always ask this of people, first time on the show, Raw Virgins. I mean, you're a fellow born in Cambridge, so how did you come to be a Brighton fan? And tell us about your first time, one assumes, watching Brighton at the Goldstone.
Yes, indeed, at the Goldstone, 1971, Pat Sayward managing, Kit Napier, John Napier, Norman Gall, etc. And I was born in Cambridge simply because my dad was at Cambridge University, and unbelievably, he was having a child while he was a student. Kind of.
Student, but, having sex, who knew?
You know. So then once he got his degree, he became a teacher in Portsmouth, which is where all his family came from, and where, in fact, I saw my first ever football match at the age of 5 with my granddad at Fratton Park. Mm-hmm. Then when I was 7, we all moved up to Sussex. He got a job at Falmer School teaching English, which he did for many years. We lived in Selmeston, which is in the Holy Ground between Lewes and Eastbourne. Mm. I think it was at the age of 13 when somebody, one of the kids, and I was playing for the school team and stuff and playing football all the time. And one of the kids said, after the game, because we used to play on Saturday mornings, we're all going down the Goldstone, you know, do you want to come? And I said, sure. I think we may have been playing in Hove against one of those teams. Mm-hmm. And so we went into the North Stand, and absolutely intoxicating, the North Stand in the 70s. It was
interesting, I imagine.
Thinking back on it now, it was absolutely mental, of course, you know. We would sing these sort of slightly racist songs and bounce up and down on that terracing, and somebody would push us and we'd all go down kind of like 20, 30.
I remember it well.
The famous surge.
And then you'd have to kind of fight your way back to roughly where you'd been before, but it was never quite the same place. And the away fans were allowed into that end, and so you'd get punch-ups and all kinds of stuff was going on. But the songs were amazing. The sense of humour of football fans is absolutely wonderful, of course, you know.
So do you remember the songs of the period of your first times there?
I certainly do, yeah.
Without swearing, please.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Ivor who? Ivor not need chicken in a bowl, lick it in. We ain't when we don't give up. Yeah, right.
But I mean, sorry, Aidy. For those of you who are not watching, because we're recording this on Zoom and we're just using the audio. I may or may not put this out on video, but if you see Ralph, he had the dirtiest grin across his face going back nearly 50 years now to the Goldstone. I'd imagine long hair, if not mulleted, scarf on wrists, and he's. The face was a picture, Ralph. Sorry, mate. Carry on.
We might have to edit that bit out.
Maybe, but.
But I mean, it's fascinating because, I mean, obviously, I mean, we asked this question to a lot of people. We did a show a long time. And usually you have a rite of passage, which is moving around the grounds. So you start on the Chicken Run or the South Stand, you move around to the West Terrace, and then you end up in the North Stand. But to end up in the North Stand first up is pretty impressive, to be honest.
I think that's where all the teenage boys went, I thought, you know what I mean? And it was like, it was just, we were surrounded by people our own age and a little bit older, you know. And the atmosphere was absolutely brilliant. And of course, there's a good old roof on it and a great echo.
Absolutely. I think what it is that when we've got people who have been on here before, they say, oh, my granddad or my dad took me first time I was about 7 or 8 and stood on an orange carton or an orange, you know, orange box or something like that. But like I say, you started probably, what, 14. So, you know, you've got to sort of like throw yourself in and be one of the hard lads, didn't you, really?
Well, I wasn't. I was never one of the hard lads, but I was standing next to them, you know, and singing. And going to the odd away game, but not really. Of course, when I started going to university in the late 70s, I started watching from the chicken run. So I was sort of moved around to the sort of slightly more intellectual and old age pensioner area. Actor, and I was living in London. I would come down. I was a season ticket holder in the deathly days of the late 90s, and the Bellotti and all of that. Mm. I was in the West End at that point, which was really interesting because Bellotti was sometimes sitting there and sometimes not, and it got very lively. And then for the very last game at the Goldstone, I was in the South Stand because I'd never been there.
That's the way to sign off, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course that's where the goal was scored as well. So it was.
I think I only saw probably about 2 or 3 games from the South Stand. So, yeah, I mean, I never saw one from the South East. But I was actually just thinking, it just reminded me of a story about how embarrassing it can be and what a lad you think you are when you're in the North Stand. And, I've got to go when I was probably about 14, 15. And it was, I think it was the first or second time I took my brother, who's about 3 years younger than me. And the chant goes up. It wasn't a rhubarb. It was one of those, if you're all going to wherever it was we were playing the next week, I suppose it was Leicester, if you're all going to Leicester, clap your hands. And you do that. And I'm joining him because I'm 14 and I'm a lad. I'm all going to Leicester, clap your hands. And just as it dies down, my brother, who's about 11, 10 or 11 at the time, says, no, Mum said you can't go. Thanks, Gary.
Okay, well, Ralph, you've had an illustrious acting career, and we'll come back to.
Hang on, you've had it. He still is having one, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. But there's a rumor that goes around that you've always tried to sneak a little bit of Albion memorabilia into every film you've been. Now, how much truth is in that? And if so, what have you managed to get in?
It's only where appropriate, really, or where I can see a gap. I mean, it was pretty tricky in Star Wars, you know, to put a bit of our memorabilia in there. But no, I think the first time I did it was in Up and Under, 96, which is a rugby film. And I was playing a teacher who played rugby union in a rugby league sevens team. Actually broke my wrist playing rugby on that game because they had real rugby players. But there was just one game where we were all sitting around in a pub and I said, can I wear this blue and white striped shirt? And the director went, yeah, sure. He said, what is it? And I said, it's Brighton and Hove Albion. He went, oh yeah, you're a southern puff to say, you might as well wear it. And I got a love from doing that, obviously from Albion fans. And then in Mean Machine, of course, my office, Mr. Burton's office, has photographs of the Albion in there. It was like a sort of public way of putting us on the map a bit. I think the club were happy that I did that, you know, we've always been, until recently, we've always been a lower league division team, you know, apart from those 4 years in the first division. And so always tried to kind of, you know, put us out there a bit more. I never supported any other team, by the way, and never wanted to.
Fair enough.
Okay, well, you live in New York now. So obviously none of us are really going to the Amex at the moment. So, I mean, which is frustrating for everybody. But I mean,
really frustrating if you live nearby, probably less so if you're in New York, I'd imagine.
No, this is true. Yeah. But I mean, how is it being a Brighton fan in New York?
What's amazing about it is, in a normal year, I would be getting back and I'd see a couple of games every season. I saw was Southampton when Andoni got sent off. I saw the West Ham game before that. And I was very, very close in the West Stand to that game. And I was amazed, to be honest, at the physicality and the athleticism of the players on both sides. It was just ridiculous, you know, the change of speed and tempo and the change of mind. But in New York, we get the most incredible Premiership coverage here on the television. So in the years since we've been in the Premiership, I've seen every single game home and away, live, you know. So I've got to know the players and the tactics and everything much better than I would do in England, where it's very hard to get access to away games that you can't manage to get to on the TV live, you know. It's all kind of stitched up, isn't it?
I mean, it's quite a scene downtown, isn't there? I think there's a couple of bars, or at least one bar that we've been reading about, because, you know, we've got a lot of followers on Twitter who are, you know, who since we've come to the Premier League, you know, started following the Albion. They've lost their Premier League team if they got relegated and found a new one. I mean, we've got a good friend of mine who's in, you know, in Pittsburgh, and I keep in regular contact with her. And, you know, there's quite a scene there. So do you actually join in with that scene down there, or is it just a case of, you know, feet up with a beer?
Well, we're 5 hours behind you guys. So a 3 o'clock kickoff is 10 a.m. over here. Yeah. The lunchtime kickoff is 7:30 in the morning. So no, I'm sitting in my pajamas on my sofa.
Yeah, I mean, there is, there's the NY Seagulls, which is a fans group for Brighton fans in New York, strangely. And there is a pub which they frequent on every match.
Do you remember which one it is?
We'll let you know. I mean, we'll post it. I don't know, we've got a lot of listeners in New York.
I've been in that pub and seen another game there, but...
It's
I went to see a World Cup game there, I think. I know where it is. There's a few games where you can see Brighton games, a few pubs.
Sure.
Not my... Okay.
There's just one thing that, while we were talking about shirts just now and where they were. Now, we tried to get you on during the summer and for whatever reason, just didn't quite happen. And we were doing a series during the summer, during lockdown, of favourite shirt of my years. Now, like I say, those who are not going to get to see this on Zoom, but you've actually hung up a couple of Albion shirts in the back of your kitchen there. And we can show that. So you're turning round. For those not watching on Super Reverb Vision, you've turned around. He's gone to the kitchen to go and fetch his shirt.
This is the long sleeve centenary shirt.
So, Ralph, tell us about that. Why is that your favourite shirt?
This shirt's got everything. It's got the perfect size blue and white stripes for the people on the spectrum like me. it's got the badge of Brighton and Hove in full colour stitched right in the middle of the chest. It's got the magic word Skint right across, who were our sponsors for 10 years and mates of mine. And the word says it all, really. They were a record label who actually sort of kept us above water when we were Skint. And then on the back, which is now rubbed off due to use, it says Zamora 25.
It was kind of a zeitgeist at that time. It was the kind of the resurrection of the club was happening. We were back home. We had a sparkling striker. We were winning divisions. But there was also, I think, that, you know, that for me, I take your point completely, but for me, there was the magic of the Skint association. There was something, for me, kind of otherworldly about that particular era.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was with Dean. Mm. And... We'd turned it around, you know. We'd got the club back from the capitalists, and we now were sort of steering towards kind of being safe, I suppose, and being a decently run club and trying to move in the right direction, but not particularly in a rush about it. And it was a good feeling. It did feel that it was our club again, you know, especially after.
And it was also the coming together of a community, because, I mean, we fought to save our club, and there's lifelong friendships formed through that.
Yeah,
I know. But it's one of those things. There was just, like you said, I think the word is zeitgeist.
You can try and explain it, Ada. You can try and explain it. You can try and put words to it. But I think it's for those who were there, for those who lived through it. And we are talking 20 years ago now. For those who lived through it, they know what it is. And they can smile with a certain satisfaction and remember that as a good time, even though we were still, you know, fourth division. But it was the starting of the building of the club that we know now. But to try and explain, you just say, well, it was good. We you know, like as Ralph said, we turned the corner. We were, you know, there was goals everywhere. We were, you know, we got our club back. And I think, yeah, you know, to a large extent, we still got it. And that shirt, I think, absolutely, I'm with Ralph on this. It yeah, really does represent something a little bit special.
Mm. And I believe that Bobby is your favourite all-time Brighton player.
Yeah, I mean, I would have said yes to that without hesitation up until a couple of years ago, and now I'm sort of embarrassed for riches, really, with the current squad. you know, I think some really good days ahead. I'm very fond of Lewis Dunk.
Sure. In that case, let me ask that question. Seeing as Ralph was there, we can't ask this of everyone. Could you do a comparison, a like-for-like comparison between Lewis Dunk and Mark Lawrenson? Is Lewis Dunk there yet?
No, and he's not the same player. And it was a different game then. Lawrenson was a Rolls-Royce of a player, and we were, you know, profoundly lucky fortunate, I would say, to have him at the club when we did. You know, he was outstanding. I mean, he was outstanding, and he was outstanding at Liverpool. But we could all see he was destined for bigger and better things than Brighton at that time. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that if he was at the club now, we'd be hanging on to him rather like we did Ben White
and Lewis Dunk.
Lewis Dunk himself,
yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about that, because the team that we do know now was in action on Monday night, with Chelsea being the visitors to the Amex, and Ralph, it was a game that was disappointing, really, because we played so well in this game, and we certainly, it was just individual errors that were proved costly, and it was similar to the blueprint from last season, where again, simple little errors cost us, but there was certainly more progression about our play.
Yeah, I thought some of that football was the best football I've ever seen Brighton ever in play in my lifetime. A couple of passages were breathtaking, but you know, we've always been a team that wants to play football ever since 1971. Anyway, when I started going, we were always one of those teams. There may have been years when we didn't really look like that, but the will was there, I think. Mm. You know, I think that the turning point of the game was when we didn't hold on to that 1-1. You know, we didn't tighten up. And you know, it's sad for Tarek Lamptey, who obviously had a blinder, that the guy that's kind of pushed him out of Chelsea is the guy that scores the game that turns the game. You know, never score a better goal than that, I wouldn't have thought, Reece James. But yeah, we should have been tighter for those 5 minutes after you score. A lot of teams forget that. And it's probably the best time to try and equalise, just like immediately.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the Chelsea opener then, because, I mean, it was a penalty that was...
Oh, yes. I'm going to say, AD, you're the only person, I think, on the planet who's going to make the case for saying it wasn't a penalty.
Well, I've watched it several times since we had that conversation. And there was gamesmanship involved in this. Basically, the ball had gone, Werner wasn't getting there, he ran it at the keeper, and the keeper obliged by sticking his leg out.
I think that's the phrase I use for you. Matty Ryan obliged him. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you pick a striker that wouldn't look for something like that.
No, I mean, we see it time and time again. I mean, VAR looked at it and they saw nothing wrong with it. But, you know, but I mean, it's the rights and wrongs of whether it was a penalty. Most people agree that it was, and I'm happy to go with the...
You weren't at the time, mate.
Well, no, I wasn't at the time. But then I was watching it on a moody stream
very low.
It might have looped up. But, I mean, the penalty was conceded due to, really, Stephen Alzatti being loose in possession. Now, we've been wanting to see him play in that position, and largely during the game, he was great.
Therein lies the point, isn't it? He came in, he looked good in the friendly. It was great to see him back. And people will criticise him for it, and quite rightly, you know, he's taken over from David Prepper in that sense. You know, there's always got a real humdinger of the mistake in each game for him. And sadly, in this instance, we're being punished for it. You know, this is what happens in the Premier League. You know, because apart from that, and we've been discussing this during the week, I thought Alzatti's game was pretty good, but, you know, he's going to get judged. you know, on that one piece. And I think that's, well, it's not unfair because it was a major sort of point in the game. But, you know, it's the fact that, you know, here we are, we concede a goal in the first half due to a sloppy mistake. You know, it's along with the mantra of we need a new striker, it's getting a little bit sort of almost boring now.
Mm. Can you remember the last time that Matty Ryan saved a penalty?
No.
Anyone? It was in March 2018 from Wayne Rooney, actually, against Everton.
Oh, Everton. I thought it was against Everton, but I didn't realise that was that long ago.
Yeah, and he saved one a couple of weeks earlier against Stoke as well. So those are the only two he saved for us. So it's,
the writing was on the wall.
Yeah.
But then, to be fair, he is a Premier League goalkeeper, which means that you expect Premier League players to stick away penalties in the way that Stockdale saved them in the Championship.
Mm. But we had two players making their Premier League debuts for the Albion in this game, in obviously Ben White and Adam Lallana. What did you make of their contributions to the game?
Go on, Ralph.
First class. I thought both of them were first class, and upgrades on where we were last season, with all due respect. I think obviously one is worried about Lallana's fitness, and of course that was, you know, he sort of went down on one knee to kind of go, I'm not going to play anymore after whatever it was, 40 something minutes, and everyone sort of thought, well, is that it? We're not going to see him for 3 months, you know. But apparently it was just cramp, and he's obviously being as careful as we all want him to be with his own fitness and protecting himself. But he's going to be really important this season, I think.
There was a really good link-up play between Lallana and Lamptey, which looks like it could prove to be absolutely a wonderful thing going forward for us this season if those two can link up like they did in this game. Because, I mean, some of that intricate interplay that we were having and the way we were carving through the Chelsea defence to create a lot of these chances, it was just wonderful to watch.
Well, the thing is, it's the word that Ralph used earlier. It's an upgrade with Lamptey, for instance. I mean, he's actually the person he reminds me of most at the moment is Kazenga Luwalua, and Luwalua really played a fullback. And more to the point, he usually came on as an impact sub, but obviously Lamptey is so much more than that. And I made the point, I still prefer Veltman to start. And I think Andy criticised me a little bit for saying that Lamptey wasn't good enough. I didn't mean that last week. I certainly thought that Lamptey was good enough, and what's more to the point, he proved it with arguably a man of the match performance, which they never give to someone who's on the losing team, by the way, which is another matter entirely. But Lamptey certainly showed a new strand of right back play that we hadn't seen. And Lallana, and to be honest, so, you know, Bissouma's linking up with him quite well. And Alzati was. They have this rotating system in the midfield. Everything is fluid. Everything has to go, you know, and be, you know, everyone has to cover everyone else. So whoever was playing alongside Lamptey at a given moment, I thought, you know, everyone linked up pretty well.
Yeah. And another plus point was players getting shots away. Alzati he drove at the Chelsea defence and he got a shot off, which was actually saved by Kepa, who apparently is not great.
You actually said we finally got a shot on target, mate.
But I mean, one thing that really annoyed me about this game was our finishing, and that's been a hangover from last season. I mean, there was one chance which it was just an absolutely wonderful ball from Lamptey into the box, which Maupai should have done a lot better with the header.
What's your take on Maupai, Ralph?
I like him very much. I've got a really good mate who's a Brentford fan, and he said, looks like you're coming in for Neil, and we loved him. He's a shithouse player. You know, I'll give you an example. When he was at Brentford, he went up to Leeds, scored a goal there. They sang songs about him against him for the rest of the game. And after the game, he was interviewed and said, so how does it feel to score at Leeds? He was like, it's lovely. He said, well, how do you feel about the fans singing all those songs about you after? And he said, oh, that's fine. He said, I'll score another goal against them when we're at home. And he did. Those players, which bit like Murray is a bit like that. Do you know what I mean? And a good striker has to have the bit of the devil in him. And I think he's definitely got that, as we saw against Arsenal.
Absolutely. I was going to mention that. Yeah, absolutely.
But my issue with him is, Al, and this is something we've talked about before. I mean, we're impressive return last year, 10 goals in your first Premier League season, but it should have been more than that because the amount of chance he's scoring, I think it's 1 in 6 gilt edge chances at the moment. It needs to be at least 1 in 3.
That header that you're talking about, he should have done a lot better with. I will grant you, it just sort of like hit his shoulder and it floated in. It's not as though Lamptey pinged it. As a striker, he'll be wanting to sort of.
He did ping it. I literally got pinged, written down.
I think he more floated it. But the thing is, for all the criticism that we have over all our strikers, I'm going to say the same for Chelsea. You know, you had the raving they had of their £35 million striker. Yeah, right, he got the penalty with a little bit of pace, but let's face it, any striker would have done that. Apart from that, he didn't actually offer a great deal during that game. So, and they got their goals, which we'll talk about in a minute, through, you know, a certain amount of luck. Well, all right, Reece James, he's never going to do that again. And Zouma, you know, with a deflection. But, you know, their strikers were not on fire as well. So, you know, it's for us really to criticise, you know, their player. Our strikers too much.
But we did score a goal, and in time on a tradition in the wonderful media, it was all about the fact that the goalkeeper should have saved it rather than what a great finish it was. But Trossard is off the mark for the season, and I think it was a fantastic finish.
It was a brilliant goal. He is a sort of an unsung hero, and he could turn into a really incredible player. I have to say, one of the things about watching football over here in Brooklyn is at the moment there, NBC have decided to give Peacock TV all of the games which they're not showing on the television, because they show every single game. Yeah. And so you can choose whether to watch it on online or on the TV. And that game was on Peacock TV, and they're trying to make, they're putting all the big teams on Peacock to make sure all the fans sign up. And after the game, they spent half an hour talking about Chelsea in immense detail.
Mm-hmm. We had exactly the same problem in England with Sky, with Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville.
Right, but they didn't actually mention Brighton once, and they went straight to the next game or whatever was happening afterwards without a single mention, without an interview with Potter, nothing.
Oh, blimey. At least we had the interview with Potter, yeah, but wow.
I mean, they would never do that in England because we have a more respectful, you know, it's a game of two teams attitude to soccer. Whereas over here, they are a little bit more commercial about it, you know?
Well, therein lies the point, isn't it? Because, I mean, I tweeted just before the game, and with their build-up, it was Chelsea, 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 Chelsea. I'm just pointing out, for anyone who's watching this game as a neutral, Chelsea are playing Brighton and Hove Albion. In case you've never heard of them, that's what's happening. And when it came to
analysis,
punditry afterwards, even talking eventually about Trossard's goal, it was about whether the keeper should have saved it, not how good it was or what they should have done or shouldn't have done or anything like that.
No, the build-up play.
Trossard scored it over here. It was just
the goal,
all that Kepa let in. You know what I mean? It was like really interesting the way human beings can talk about the same thing in completely different ways.
So the final score, according to the Americans, was Chelsea 3.
Yeah,
that's about right. I mean, we've got to mention James's goal though, because it was a wonderful goal. You don't stop those. I mean, it's unfortunate it was against us, but it was an absolute pinger into the top corner. But
it was a worldie, Brian.
It was a worldie. Yeah, I mean, you could argue that the defence should have closed him down a bit quicker, but those ones normally end up in row Z. Sadly for us, the net got in the way.
Yeah, and then Dunkey had a chance to equalise. He didn't. But, it was, we've got a lot to get through. So, Dunkey, you've got away with that one. But don't do it again, all right? If you're listening, don't do it. Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast. As ever, we brought to you in association with the wonderful oldfootballshirts.com. Over 110,000 shirts on there now for your delight and delectation. Get on there, have a look at them all. No, not all in one sitting. That was forever, isn't it?
Ridiculous.
But this is one that Phil has selected for Shirt of the Week. And I'll send it over to the boys here. So if you could, Ralph, if you could just have a look at that and describe it for me, and see if you can guess who it is.
Well, it's a kind of, I would say a kind of 80s stroke 90s flecked pattern of a sort of a tangerine kind of deep yellow. I'm not going to use the word gold, but it did remind me a little bit of Wolves. Yeah. Sponsor is Fujitsu. I would say that's a decent looking shirt. You know, I would be quite happy if my team had one of those shirts in its history. And
I know who this is, but do you want to have a guess, Ralph?
I completely cheated and looked it up before the
it's Cambridge United, isn't it?
It is Cambridge United. Put some more meat on the bones of the shirt. So basically, the pattern on the shirt is very similar to the Arsenal Bruce Banana shirt.
Yeah.
But the colour is actually amber with a black collar. It's also, I can't quite see who the manufacturer is. Oh, Influence is made by the manufacturer.
The thing is, it's a shirt I associate with Dion Dublin and John Beck and, you know, the Route One stuff.
Well, yeah, well, let's have a look at this and see what Phil has to say about this particular shirt. He says, do you want to put a year on it, by the way?
89-90.
Ralph?
92.
I'm going to give this one to Ralph. It's 91 to 93, so 92 obviously falls in that. So you are the winner. You get this shirt. okay. And this is the 91 to 93 home shirt of League Two side Cambridge United, chosen as, I believe, your guest hails from that part of the world. Nicknamed rather imaginatively, they are called the U's, and they play at the 8,127 capacity Abbey Stadium. In fact, when the club was formed in 1912, they were called Abbey United, and they took the name Cambridge United in 1951. The club was elected the Football League in 1970, replacing Bradford Park Avenue, and Ron Atkinson was appointed manager in 1974. And under Ron, they came successive promotions from 1976, which saw the U's playing in the second division in 1978. During their time in Division Two, they set an unwanted league record of the most successive league games without a win. Any ideas how many games it was?
31.
It was 31.
Sorry. It's actually very heavily mentioned in Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch, because when he was at Cambridge University, he went to watch Cambridge United a lot, and it's just one of those things that stuck with me.
Okay, so you're not really that much of an anorak. Okay, that's good.
No.
Well, you are. We know that.
Yes, I am.
Okay, and it was a record which stood until 2008 when Derby County surpassed it. Cambridge have had a number of notable players over the years. Dean Dublin made his name with the U's, 156 appearances and 52 goals between 91 and 92. Brian Moore joined from West Ham in 1956 and scored a record 80 goals for the side, despite being blind in one eye. Mark Albrighton was there for a bit, Gary Brazil, Dean Holdsworth, David Moyes spent two seasons there. But for me, their standout former player has to be beloved of the Goldston North Stand, the legendary Scott McLeish, who is still playing for Edgware Town, even to this very day. I can't repeat what Phil's written here, but insert your own expletive, basically. There's plenty of links to the Albion. Here's a few. Cambridge's current manager is Colin Cornwood, assisted Chris Hughton for a season. The oldest link I could find is David James, who he left the Albion in... Oh, I don't know. Did David James say that?
David James didn't play for us.
No, I don't know what he's on about here. Other Albion links, Alex Ravel, Mark McCammon, Wayne Gray, Bradley Johnson, Chris Holroyd, Mark Flatt, Mark Farrington, Trevor Benjamin, Paul Clark, Tom Dallinson, Jamie Campbell, and Martin Ling. So thanks for that, Phil.
It's not the hottest 11 we'll ever know, is it?
No. But, no. Well, he meant Mark McCammon and Mark Farrington in the same sentence. What could possibly go wrong?
So you are listening to the Albion Roar. As for anyone who's listening to this, especially if people are listening just because Ralph is on, we were a football club who were in turmoil back in the mid-90s. We all remember it. But, you know, Ralph, tell us about your part in the crash and burn of Archer and Bellotti.
Well, it would take too long to tell you all about that. I mean, I remember I was a contributor to Goals Eye at the time, which was a fantastic fanzine, which sort of turned from being a fanzine supporting the club to fanzine very much against the ownership of the club, and brought a lot of people together, run by Ian Hart and Peter Kennard. Mm-hmm. And they organised a boycott of one of the home games. There were various things that we tried over that time to get the attention of the media. There was a fantastically famous abandoned game, crossbar being broken before kickoff and so on. But this was a game, a home game against Mansfield on I think it was an evening game, actually.
It was a Saturday game, October 96.
Remember it being dark, so it must have been the winter.
Yeah.
And we just stood out, those of us who wanted the game boycotted, stood outside, we were given a trial each, and we had to talk fans into, we were like a picket line, talking fans into not going in, to express the displeasure that we had with the ownership, who were trying to sell the ground out from under our feet without a plan for where we would play the following season. And I remember just, you know, trying, you know, talking quite a few fans. I was over on the West End side because that was where I sat. And we, you know, failed really to get the ground emptied. But we did, many thousands decided not to go in. Many hundreds, maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, once the game started with a very small crowd, we all kind of went round to the opposite side, which would be the Chicken Run, led by one of the Gull's Eye stormtroopers, in inverted commas, Paul Camelin. One Paul Camelin, who's still with the club, and a friend of mine as well, and probably you two as well. But he kind of made his name really that night by breaking into the Chicken Run, and we all kind of surged through the gates, the metal gates there, down onto the Chicken Run, which was otherwise empty. Went across the pitch, got the game stopped for a second, I think. Went into the south stand, made friends with the Mansfield fans, who then followed us up into the west stand, where Bilotti no doubt made his hasty exit. I think the game actually carried on after that.
It was a 1-1 draw in the end. Denny Mundy scored an equalising penalty for us. So
it was an extraordinary atmosphere, really. And the rest of that season carried on in kind of similar vein, really, with different stunts that we would pull to get the fans of other clubs involved, which happened, obviously, Fans United, famously, and get the media attention. But it didn't, in the end, stop the ground from being sold, which was simply the worst day in the history of the club, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I mean, on that note, it would be wrong of us not to bring up the plight of Macclesfield Town. Mm-hmm. Who, through poor ownership, they've just been wound up this week. And obviously, this could have, we fought really hard to save this club, and their supporters have done as well. And, you know, what a lot of people seem to forget, and there's, you know, most of the column inches this week in the media are going to Gareth Bale, but a community's just lost its heart. It's football club, and this, it means so much to so many people, and without what we did here and our inventive campaigns, that could have so easily been us, and we can't ever forget that.
Absolutely, and Bury, of course, as well.
Yeah, again, and Southend could be on the brink.
Southend are staring down both barrels. They've got a High Court petition winding up order next month. I mean, it's when you see the figures for it as well. I mean, our figures. I mean, we ended up in front of the High Court, and this is the early 90s. You know, for £300,000 worth of unpaid tax bills, which, you know, I guess somewhat anecdotally, Hal Wilkinson bailed us out by buying Mark Beeney from us for way over the top of what he needed. He could have bought him for. So I mean, it's one of those stories that people say, well, the greatest saviour was him from a goalkeeper. Well, it was probably Mark Beeney leaving for Leeds. But we had that in those days, and 300,000, I suppose, obviously is a lot more than the Macclesfield's 500,000. But when you see the imbalance of that, and we're part of that gravy train now, but when you see that imbalance, you realise that I'm sure that this was also unnecessary. You know, the debtors seemed to be three main people, one of which was HMRC, who obviously always want their pound of flesh. But one was an ex-manager who hadn't been paid, and one was a solicitor who hadn't been paid. Now, it's not as though you'd expect these people not to actually chase their debt, but somewhere down the line, I'm sure a happy medium could be could be reached, but reading between the lines, it did look as though the owner did have no intention of paying, because, you know, he'd been given chance after chance after chance. And this is what sticks in the craw, is the point that you're making, AD, is that it's not a rich man's plaything, that is actually something that's so much more unquantifiable. You know, and therefore being, you know, at the heart of the community. And it's you know, the town of Macclesfield no longer has a professional football club, and that is going to hurt
Wigan, just, you know, also getting messed about.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there seems to be, and it's a pattern that seems to, you know, be repeated. You've got, you know, people who just want to see it as a plaything. You know, they know they're not part of the Premier League, want to be a big noise in their own thing, and realise that it's actually, I think not only should there not be a fit and proper person's test, there should be a test that says, actually, do you know how to run a football club? You know, because it is a unique set of skills required. You know, we're lucky in as much as that we have an owner who's very rich, but he also knows what he doesn't know. And he's supported by two very well-respected men in the game, Dan Ashworth and Paul Barber, two highly respected football administrators. And those are the kind of people that you need to run your football clubs, not just some charlatan who's got a few quid in the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, with these clubs as well, I mean, they rely on people coming through the gates, as we've documented over the last few weeks anyway. And there is, the Football League is trialling having some fans in the ground on 10 games across the EFL this week. So I mean, hopefully that goes okay. But, you know, we're not out of the woods this yet.
Ralph, is there any move stateside to have fans returning to games at all?
They're having limited numbers of fans at American football matches. I think maybe 15% capacity, something like that.
Okay, and that's the big sort of like the high end stuff, that, you know, the, what do you call it, the NFL size. Yep. We're talking college football.
NFL.
Yeah. NFL. Right. So we're talking about crowds of sort of what, 10,000 to 15,000 then.
That's right. So that is we're tiptoeing towards that, but basically we're in the same situation as we were in March. There is a virus out there which we are not immune to. And so that hasn't changed at all. Mm. So we need to kind of reinvent the wheel a bit and start thinking about, and some people have, like I get into taxis now and there's a big sort of cellophane screen in between the front seats and the back seats, and you can't get in unless the window's open and you're wearing a mask, for example. I was amazed when Brighton did that friendly against Chelsea pre-season and let some people into the ground who were socially distanced cleverly, but none of them had to wear a mask when they were in their seats. I thought, what's the problem? What is the problem with putting a flipping mask on? You know,
I mean, everyone had to wear masks on the concourses, and they were policing that as well, ensuring that people
did. You
were
not wear them on your seats though, AD?
Some did, some didn't. But in the seats, I mean, you're miles away from anyone. They worked out the seating was particularly well thought out. You're at least 2 meters away from anybody else there, and you're outside. So, but
do you think that's enough, though? Do you think that's enough?
Well, I don't know what the science is, Al, to be honest. But I mean, I think that from what I've seen and heard back from the club on this one, it was successful. They obviously, we want to get fans back into the ground as soon as possible, but not until it's safe to do so. And that's the long and short of it, isn't it?
I mean, we've been having the conversation until we're blue in the face. Well, I happen to know the government is relying quite a lot on the Albion's testimony. You know, the FSA got hold of me to say, what's the fans' point of view here? But obviously the club, the Albion themselves, are, you know, they're actually at the forefront of, you know, whatever happens next. So, you know, whatever they do, you know, let's hope that, you know, there's still lessons to be learned. As much as you enjoyed it, AD, as much as you sort of like, you know, had a good time and you know, you felt it worked, you know, there's still always lessons, as the club says, there's always lessons to be learned.
My main issue with the whole day had nothing to do with the club. It was more all to do with the transport. And it was just one particular train that you and I both got on at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And that's nothing to do with the club.
Okay, let's move on from there a little bit, but we're going to keep the pandemic in mind for a second here, Ralph, because, I mean, obviously, you're an actor. You told us off air that you've not worked since the pandemic. How has it been for you? Because, I mean, we're seeing lots of people using technology to perform and to create, be creative with it. I mean, is that something that you've been doing, or is it something you're keen to do?
No, I mean, I'm a writer as well. I've written a couple of plays, and I've written a film. I've written 9 films, but I've actually got one of them made, so that's why I say I've written a film. I've written a film, got made, you know. So I sort of go into the writing when at the moment, and trying to write things that people actually want to make, so that I get paid. So it's but yeah, no, I haven't earned anything apart from residuals since March. Residuals and royalties being exactly the same thing, but residuals sounds slightly fancy.
Is that repeats? Is that what we call repeats?
Yeah, it's when things are shown or rented or whatever. Yeah.
So with obviously the current streaming stuff, and obviously films like, for instance, With Now and I, which is probably what you're best known for, really. That gets shown a lot on TV, probably late at night, but it gets shown a lot. And
are you actually asking him how much he gets paid here?
Well, no. But I mean, obviously, with the streaming sites and everything else, with Netflix and. Not many people realise how little artists get paid for having their songs on Spotify. Is that the same for actors with films?
Yeah, I mean, most people aren't interested, to be fair. But for those who are, With Nell and I, it was a classic example of a buyout, which is to say, would you like to do this part in this film? And if so, this is what you're going to get. And it'll, I think it was... you know, less than 10,000, that film is probably more like 3. But then having earned that money, that's it. You'll never earn another penny again from that film. It's right. Called a buyout. So there's no residuals. There's nothing like that. In America, that doesn't happen, that you can't actually make a film under those conditions in America. Every actor has to be in the union, and the union has got kind of guidelines for how future exploitation is shared out amongst the cast and the crew. That's one very good reason for moving over here. In England, a lot of the work that I've done in England, especially on the film side, no residuals, only residuals from the BBC and ITV and things like that.
Yeah, because I mean, stuff like Ashes to Ashes, which you were also in, that's getting shown a lot, particularly now, and the box sets are all on the iPlayer and things like that. So, I mean,
Life on Mars I was in. I wasn't in
Ashes. Oh, sorry, my mistake.
But yeah, that's I will get a few bob for that, but it will be a few bob.
Yeah.
Sure. I'll tell you what I was watching the other day, Adi. You know, they've reset Van der Valk. I was actually then sort of flicking through the old ones and actually realised you were in the last ever one of the previous series with Barry Foster, weren't you?
Yeah, Rob Barry, yeah, it was. I've kind of been in most things, you know what I mean?
It's the Sweeney, Minder, Casualty, The Bill. Well, obviously with The Bill, you're one of the founder members of The Bill.
From 83 onwards, I've probably been in most of those kind of regular things, like, you know, Frost or... you know what I mean? I was there, ones where they have guest actors in every week. I mean, I've never done Midsummer. There's only a handful I haven't done, but I've done most of them. Of course, once you've done them, you can't go back and do them again because you've done it.
Sure.
But I mean, reading about some of your stuff earlier, Ralph, I mean, I found out that Neil Morrissey is a Palace fan. How is that possible?
Did you not know?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of my best friends are Palace fans, I personally don't feel any hatred towards Crystal Palace. I feel rivalry towards them, as I would towards Southampton and Newcastle and Burnley, you know. But I don't.
You missed one out, which is a nice segue, because you missed out Portsmouth, and that's who we played this week. But Portsmouth certainly didn't wing it last night, and they went down 4-0. It was with 4 different scorers as well, 3 of which getting their first Albion goals. And Al, it was a very, very strong second string side.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a second string side mostly made up of players who you'd expect to be at the very least on the bench. I mean, that's not to say that the Chelsea first, the 11 that was picked, don't forget, Potter does change his team quite a lot. There was a fair few in that team. When you say the second string, they're still actually regular first teamers. But the point I was going to make, and it's actually alluding to that something that Ralph was saying earlier on about sort of comparing players from the third and fourth division to the luxury of the players we've got now, is that I think that that game, more than any other, set down the marker as to where we've come from since we moved to the Amex. So when we were in the third, last summer in the third tier, which is 10 years ago, 10 seasons ago, we played XYZ, we were really good under Gus Poyet, we destroyed the third division, but we were a third division team. Who could compete? But, you know, I remember playing Stoke that season and they tore us apart. Now, like this season, we've played Portsmouth and what we've shown is, Portsmouth are an upper, top half of the table side, but we show them how to play football. We look so controlled, so good, so relaxed. And when you see a top half of the table third division side, that was us 10 years ago. So that transition, which we've seen in increments over 10 years, you actually got to see in one hit last night.
I remember that season because I knew that we were on the way up. I think we all felt that feeling that we talked about earlier, the skint era. And I just remember deciding to go to the Hartlepool away game and the Walsall away game because I just thought, we're never going to play those clubs again in the league. I remember feeling that and making those decisions to collect those away grounds I hadn't been to before. And there were ones that I didn't think I'd get a chance to see.
I do miss those grounds as well. I mean, going to places like Rochdale, which you wouldn't really go to, and Carlisle, which is one of our favourite away games ever, because we found a beautiful cottage just off Windermere. It's great. Do you think the gap is? I mean, there's a lot of talk about it. The gap is clearly bigger now than it was then 10 years ago.
I still think it's 11 against 11, and I still think on the day in these cup competitions that if you turn up, you can beat anyone. You know, and I think that's the beauty of football, isn't it? You know, Liverpool had a few shocks last season, and it was a season before. I think players, you can buy players from lower league, suddenly they're Premier League players, you know, and it's like, well, it's all fluid. But yeah, the structure and the kind of like over 90 minutes you would expect. And, you know, we have got an amazing manager at the moment who will exploit any spaces which are offered to us, which we clearly did last season.
And it was a wonderful performance. 23 attempts on goal, 10 of them on target, 4 goals, 3 different goal scorers. Alireza Jahanbakhsh.
Well pronounced. You've seen him, obviously. You know, you probably a little bit more dispassionately, Ralph, from when you're watching him stateside. What have you made of Ali J?
I'm glad we've kept him. I'm really felt for him. I think he took a long time to settle in. I think, for whatever reason, he's lost confidence going from Holland over to England and into the Premiership, and so didn't tend to get a run out with Houghton or with Potter until, of course, that incredible Chelsea goal and the goal he scored before that, where he kind of wept, you know, and I think all of us went, God, I can't remember the last time I saw a Brighton player weeping after scoring a goal. It was incredible.
Knockout did that quite a bit.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he? Yeah. Bless him. Because his dad, I guess, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
But no, I'm a fan of his, and I'm very proud that we've got an Iranian player. That probably sounds like quite a stupid kind of lefty thing to do, but it's like I used to like the fact that we had two Israeli players, one Arab and one Jewish, and I was always very proud of that, you know, that we're kind of, we're a club that pulls people together, you know, and he seems right for me to be like an Iranian superstar playing for us. And I just wish him the best. I think he's going to have a really good season.
Yeah, I mean, Ralph, I mean, there you are, stateside, 3,500 miles away, you know, getting back to supporting your team. I suppose I think I'd probably struggle to be so far away when I want to watch my team. So what does it mean to be a Brighton Hove Albion fan? Well, one, for all these years, but two, at a distance.
Well, it's, you know what it's like. If you're mixing with people you don't particularly know and there's a football conversation and somebody says, who do you support? And you say Brighton, you get two different responses. The first one is of pity. disrespect, frankly. Do you know what I mean? It's what have you ever won kind of attitude, you know? Yeah, exactly. And this is from Glory Hunter fans, you know. Yeah, my connection with the team is kind of umbilical. It's you know, when we're playing at home, I think as somebody who came from a dysfunctional family, that was very profound. That was a very, and you know, our club had a dysfunctional moment, but playing at home for me is very deep, is a very meaningful thing. And that will carry on until the day I die. So being over here hasn't changed it at all in a way. It's kind of deepened it and strengthened it. And I can now see more games than I can see in England, but I can't see them live. I miss the live experience, although I do in normal circumstances, i.e. without a virus, get over there and catch a couple of games.
But, and that's a good place to leave it. So thank you so much to Ralph Brown. Thank you to Alan Wears. I've been Aidan Packham. Of course, we'll be back next week, and we'll look forward to seeing you then. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I know all there is to know.